Look at that. I don't have to have a clip on anymore? That does? High tech. You folks have gone high tech. I am very impressed. Wow. Used to have a little box in my pocket. I'd be wired. I'd get going and be pounding myself. Killing the equipment. Oh, yes. Could somebody grab me a glass of water just in case it all dries up? Thank you. I'm out of training. What's your next obligation?
Rosary at six.
Okay, I won't keep you out. I promise that. It goes on too long, so I start throwing things. Or you should get one of those things they used to have on vaudeville stages. If the act was really bad, they had a giant hook. Or just put it out there and haul the performer off the stage. Where the phrase get the hook, that's where it comes from. Maybe you can make a hook overnight and be ready for tomorrow.
Back when I taught, we used to have blackboards with chalk. Well, this is real modern stuff now. You're right, it's white, it's not black anymore. You write on it with this felt stuff, and it still erases. Boy, those weren't the times I lived in.
Very happy to be back again. Very good to see you all. And very pleased that the ash cloud hasn't hit here yet. So, but I find it fascinating. I know other people who are traveling both ways, and it's almost as if last week there was an Ash Thursday and an Ash Friday and an Ash Saturday, and those of us who are Catholic know the meaning of those ashes, and maybe now everyone in Europe will be reminded of it, and as it spreads throughout the world may have to take recognition again of what ashes mean, and perhaps it's God's way of telling the world to get ready to do penance. Entirely possible. But we're here today to speak of comedy. And indeed, what I'm going to do this afternoon, tonight, and then tomorrow afternoon, is talk about what are called the three golden comedies. Shakespeare wrote a number of other comedies. I've spoke about a number of them here before at the seminary. I've lectured on Love's Labour's Lost and A Midsummer Night's Dream and The Merchant of Venice, Taming of the Shrew, all very great comedies. But these three comedies are considered the pinnacle of Shakespeare's comic period. Discovery of himself as a playwright and the first works he did. So time-wise, while he had a number of other very successful plays, especially the English history plays, he had written a couple of tragedies that were very successful, one you probably don't know called Titus Andronicus, one you do know, a little piece called Romeo and Juliet. He'd done some other things, but what defines Shakespeare's early career? Comedy. Now, I'm not going to go into comedy at length this afternoon. I've done it before, and if you want, really, I think the best summary of what comedy is at length, get the Midsummer Night's Dream lecture that I gave. I do an extended discussion of comedy there. But I'll do a little survey here. But I want to make a couple of points about comedy before we get into much ado about nothing this afternoon. Why are these considered the golden comedies? They're considered three of the greatest comedies ever written by anybody. And quite beyond that, these three plays are considered among the pinnacle of great comic works ever created. There are only a handful of works that can really be named in the same breath as these three great comic plays. And in fact, if I had to name another work or two that ranked with these, I would be hard-pressed and would have to turn to the world of opera. And indeed, to my mind, the one work that is a comedy as great as the three Shakespeare golden comedies is Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. Glorious music, a great comic work, and has the depth, the complexity, the richness that you find in these three plays. So I'm going to do something that is probably not really good in one sense. It's a terrible thing to explain comedy and jokes. You just had the delight of watching what I think is a very fine production of Much Ado About Nothing. But now I'm going to start getting serious and talking about what's really going on there. Don't forget that the core, the heart of comedy is joy. Sheer joy. And the principal delight in watching a great comedy is that we come to the end of it, not just with a sense of joy, but ready to go back out into the world, which we know is a veil of tears, but to go back out into the world and briefly wipe the tears away, take a deep breath, and have the courage to go on, knowing that there are times in this world created by God when we experience great, wonderful, overwhelming joy, and we must never forget that's part of life. And in comedy, that is the end of the structure. Everything in the structure is pointing towards that final harmony, that final peace, that final reconciliation that creates this magnificent sense of optimism, hope, and joy in the human heart that says it can all work out. In spite of all the difficulties, it can all work out. Problems can be resolved. Compromise can come, regeneration is possible, and from all of this comes this explosion of joy. You feel it there at the end. It's just, yeah, yeah, because there are moments along the way you're not sure you're going to get there. I will talk about that at length. It's very clear. Shakespeare's vision is not a very simple, easy one. You get what you want, everybody's happy, the world works very nicely, things run smoothly, not by a long shot. Not by a long shot. It takes serious human effort, depth of personality, and spiritual courage in order to get to the end of a comedy. Now, as most of you know, I retired over a year ago, and I've been leading the good life ever since. It's very nice. I recommend retirement to everyone, especially the young. The younger you are, just retire at once because life is good. It doesn't work that way, unfortunately. Of course, one stays quite busy. One of the surprises for me was I don't have to dress up anymore during the day. Okay, so I'm surprised at how much smaller my shirts have become when I started buttoning the collar again and putting them on. It's mysterious. They're doing something at the laundry to make my shirts shrink. But during my many years of teaching, and it was a great honor to teach all those years, and I just was awarded by the Naval Academy the title of Professor Emeritus. So I had no title for about 14 months, meaning I was nobody. And I was just notified that I am now officially Professor Emeritus at the Naval Academy, which means I have a place to park when I go to Annapolis. No additional money or no high honors, but I will have a place to park. I can keep my parking tags. In this world, there's no higher honor. If you've got a place to park, you're doing really well in this world. So anyway, I have a title again so I can pretend to be somebody once again. In any case, during the years I taught, and it was a great honor, I loved teaching. They paid me to teach Shakespeare. Shh, they can't take it away from me now. I would have done it anyway because I love this stuff. I only in all those years had one original thought. There are no original thoughts. Okay. Even if you think you've come up with something new, somebody else has done it. Okay. The intellectual life is like a torch race. It just keeps being passed on, and occasionally it burns a little brighter, and on occasion there's a fear that the torch may go out. But basically, what has been thought is what's been thought before, and the best we can do is hand it on and keep it going and make sure it's there. We're Catholics. That's called tradition. It's extremely important. It's true in all spheres. It's certainly true in the religious sphere, where it's one of the pillars of our faith. In the secular world, it is every bit as important. Tradition is hugely important. The best you can do is pass on what wiser minds than your own have done before. That's a great, great good. I had one original thought in 38 years of teaching, and it was this. Shakespeare's career as a playwright parallels the mysteries of the Rosary. For me, it's one of the fundamental proofs that the man had to be Catholic. And right now, the hottest field in Shakespeare studies is his Catholicism. It's becoming clear. It's popping up everywhere. I can talk more about that tonight. I'm going to leave some room for questions and answers tonight. So perhaps we can get into that then. But what I mean by that is simply this. If on a given day you were to process yourself through and pray all the mysteries of the Rosary, you would begin with the joyful mysteries, you would move on to the sorrowful mysteries, and you would end with the glorious mysteries. Shakespeare's career is divided into three basic parts. The comic plays, plays filled with great joy, followed by the tragedies, some of the most profound and troubling and sorrowful plays ever written by anyone, and they end with the great romances, a series of four extraordinary plays about providential design, resurrection, and a little glimpse of what heaven may be. They are glorious plays, in the most profound and in the most Catholic sense of the word. He moved from joyful plays to sorrowful plays to glorious plays. Accidental? I think not. But what we're looking at now is that moment of most profound joy where, having looked at the world through a comic framework, if you will, the vision of a younger man, not that young, but a younger man who could look at the world and take delight in it, he wrote these quintessential comic plays that are filled with the most profound joys that we can know in the secular sphere, in the world in which we live. Now, what are those joys? Why do I link them? And I link them very directly with the joys of the Rosary. Although they're not parallel in terms of their importance, they are not parallel in any way in terms of the glorious higher vision. We're talking secular. But we also know as Catholics that supernature builds on nature. And in order to have a healthy supernatural life, you have to have a profound and solid natural base. And that's what Shakespeare is exploring in these great comedies, is the natural joys of the comic vision of what's best and possible about living in this world, okay? So that's where we are, in the natural sense, but with the enormous implications that are higher, enormous implications that point towards eternal truths. What is comedy? A very quick definition. If all drama is about conflict, as Aristotle says, okay, in his definition of tragedy, we lost his essay on comedy, but we can extend this out there. It is the imitation of an action, okay? It's an imitation of an action that is performed, obviously live, with a beginning, a middle, and an end, okay? It is structured. The action is structured. Now, what makes comedy unique is that the basic conflict in comedy is almost always social. And the comic conflict is between the individual human being. That's me, that's you, that's each individual human being that is a package, a unique individual package of talent, gifts, desires, personality, willfulness, flaws, problems, okay? Each one an individual creation by God, a unique soul, with a vision that is all our own. That's one side of the conflict. The other side of the conflict is the social order. Very few of us can live as hermits by ourselves. We live in communities. We live in societies. And the whole point of a social order is that we are better off, for the most part, living in groups. We have to live with other people. So that the basic tension is, I am an individual. I have my own way of looking at things. I know what I want. I have my own demands. I have my own problems. I have my own flaws. This life is about me. Number one, Mr. Important. Here I am. And the fact that the world I live in says, no. You are one cog in a very large social machine, and the whole thing has to operate together. If it's going to work at all, then the whole thing has to work together, and you have to submit to the good of the group. Before whatever you want individually, the good of the group comes first. The conflict between an individual and the group creates drama. Okay? What comedy says is you can have it both ways. It is possible to settle that conflict in a good, solid, affirmative, hopeful, compromising, but reconciliatory way. It can all work out in the end. Okay? Now, as we live in any given era, you're going to find that we live somewhere along a scale that goes from one to the other. That is, there are societies that are so restrictive, you have no individual will, no individual freedom, you can do nothing, you are part of the state will tell you how you live, you are only a member of the group. Can you say totalitarianism? Can you say Stalin? Can you say this horrible, crushing, social pressure from above that allows you no individuality at all? Right, comrades? Right. Right, comrades, Stalin. Okay? We've seen this. We've seen it in recent times. It's always coming back. It's a fearful thing. Now, that's an extreme case. But it's also true at any given time. You can live in a time where there are certain restrictions and it makes many people uncomfortable and they want to express themselves more freely. They want to show what they can do. They want what I want what I want. I don't care what you all want. I want what I want. And it's a problem. And if we swing too far in the other direction, that is, I am an independent atom whirling around, and you can't tell me how to live. You can't tell me what I should do. I have my opinion, and you have no right to tell me, because I know what I... You end up with the Washington Beltway. 600,000 cars on any given week with no respect for law or any other car anywhere around them, all going... What is called road rage is really the ultimate expression of individuality. This is my car. I am the driver. I am the king behind my steering wheel. And I get this constantly. In fact, I got it just driving down here from Minneapolis this morning. People behind me saying, you should not exist. Get out of my way. You have no business being on the road in front of me, which is why we get the thing that drives me mad. It's called tailgating. There's no reason they can't be 3 feet, 4 feet behind me, rather than on top of my bumper, where I know if a child ran in the road and I had to put on the brakes, it's just metal and crushed and horror and death everywhere because they're running. I mean, why are you there? It's because this road, this traffic is about me, the individual, and you have no right being there. This is a true story. I do not make this up. If you don't believe me, you can go on the computer and find this to be true. This happened 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C., the hideous beltway. Dante couldn't have imagined. The beltway is circular, but it would be way down. I mean, it would be a lower circle, okay? A garbage truck and a Jaguar. I don't make this up. The two are coming to the entrance. They're going down an entrance ramp onto the beltway. The Jaguar will not move over to allow the dump truck to go past him. The dump truck insists, for some reason, he has a right to be on the beltway first. The Jaguar says, you have no such right because all of the beltway, and particularly this entrance ramp, is about me. I am an individual. I am an Adam, and I possess sole right to this beltway, especially this entrance ramp. And the garbage truck got angry and began trying to drive the Jaguar into the wall, into the retaining wall, i.e. to crush the life out of the car and the driver of the car and the two-year-old daughter in the car. So the dump truck is pushing the Jaguar into the retaining wall. The Jaguar scrapes along the wall. The dump truck starts going forward. The Jaguar, driver of the Jaguar, is so infuriated, he reaches into his glove compartment and pulls out his gun, gets out of the car, and fires 13 shots into the dump truck. Just another day in Washington. Now, fortunately, he must have had an American education in firing handguns. He didn't hit anything. Maybe a few bottles in the back or some orange rinds. I don't know. But the driver was unharmed. But needless to say, other people driving at this point realize there's a lunatic standing there firing guns at them. They were both arrested for attempted murder. This is individuality run amok. Okay? There is no one else in the world. There's only Mr. Number One, A Number One, the total most important. One of the fearful things about modern democracy is that it swings us to the absolute other end and says you're free to do anything you want. You can be whomever you want to be. No one can tell you anything. It's all about you, you, you. Whew, those are the two extremes. And they're terrible extremes. And indeed, if you go too far one way, as Aristotle observes, before you can get back to the golden mean, the center where life should be lived, you've got to swing all the way in the opposite direction. It's frightening. It's fearful. That's why we're also told by that wise Greek that all democracies end in tyranny. It's a very sensible idea. Makes perfect sense. What comedy says, and Shakespeare never goes that far, is fortunately still lived within a modicum of social order, is that conflict between what the individual wants and what the group wants can be resolved. Can be resolved. And even though the tensions are there and it looks as if I as an individual cannot have what I want, I have to submit to the group, and at times it looks like the whole social order is going to be taken apart because of the assertion of a single individual, i.e. Don John and the destroyed marriage, okay? Even though a comedy can come to the point where it looks as if this whole thing's going to come apart, no happy ending is possible, comedy says, yes, it is possible. We can make it through these ordeals, we can get to the end, and there can be compromise in which society says to the individual, you must do what you want to do. And the individual says, well, what I want to do is be part of the social order. Everybody wins, and it's why the emblems for it have always been number one, marriage. Number, there's a reason why almost all great comedies end in marriage. Because marriage is the place where individual desire can be fulfilled and individual happiness can be achieved, and the social order gets what it wants, which is the ongoing social structure of the family and new life and new children and the sense of a future. And as a result, at the end of a comedy, we feel, oh, it can all work out. Look how that worked out. I didn't think that was going to work out. Yes, I can get what I want. Yes, the society can be happy because it gets what it wants. So let's dance. And that's the second emblem. A lovely dance in which, not a modern dance where people are just jumping up and down. Okay. No, a lovely dance in which there are patterns and figures that rely on the individual dancer, but the overall pattern includes the whole group. And hence the beauty of the dance at the end of a comedy. Because you are absorbed into something much larger than the self, but boy, to be in that dance and be part of it and kicking up your heels and feeling that energy and joy, because why? I just married the woman I love. Whee! Okay? It's a glorious and wonderful thing. Now, that's all in terms of the social order. And that's all extremely important. But let me just give a hint of the higher ramifications. And the higher ramifications are indeed this. It is no accident that the first miracle our Lord performed was at a wedding. And it is no accident that that first miracle was in order that the joy of the wedding might continue after the wine had run out. Now, we all understand the larger theological implications of that, and they are profound. Our Lord changing water into wine, and at the Last Supper, the wine would be turned into his very blood. It's profound. I'm simply looking at it on a simpler level, but a miraculous level. That our Lord's first miracle was to ensure that the joy of the wedding feast continue. Which suggests that God himself approves of such joy. And the second thing, of course, is that the request came from our Blessed Mother herself. They've run out of wine, she says. Now, of course, again, our Blessed Mother, the most wonderful woman who ever walked the planet, but still very much a woman, she's aware of the domestic situation. No man would notice the wine was gone until his glass was empty. A good woman is going to be aware of the social circumstances and know ahead of time when the wine's run out. And she says they've run out of wine. And our Lord says, woman, my time has not yet come. And the next thing he says is, tell the steward to fill the jugs with water. Meaning that the divine plan was changed at Our Lady's request so that water could become wine and the joy of the marriage feast could continue. Because the marriage feast on earth, of course, is a natural indication of that glorious marriage feast to come another day. The wine into water is a glorious indication of the wine into blood. And the implications are that marriage itself, and this isn't a surprise, we know this, marriage itself is a sacrament instituted by God himself, and to enter into such a sacrament is a great good for the individuals involved and a greater good for the whole community. And the reason for that has got to be, as I said earlier, that out of it, the community is continued. Life continues. Up until the Second Vatican Council, the consistent teaching of the church was the reason for marriage was to have children. The well-being of the individuals was there, but it was secondary. It is no accident that in confusing the two ends and pretending they're equal, you wound up with a world that one is filled with divorce and two has fewer and fewer children in it. Certainly among Christian couples or those that were raised in a Christian environment. It is not accidental. Let me just point out how Shakespeare is fully aware of this. It's one of the great comic lines in the play, and it is a comic line. Benedict overhears the plot, the trick, where they're saying Beatrice loves him. He's trying to say, just jars him awake. But notice instantly he starts trying to convince himself that it could be true. Well, maybe this is true. And, they're going to make fun of me because I've railed against marriage. I was going to be the old bachelor. And the convincing argument, it's wildly funny, is when he finally says, the world must be peopled. It's very funny. But it's comic joy at the recognition of a Catholic teaching that was always the primary Catholic teaching, that that is the primary end of marriage. At that moment, we know how it's going to end up. We don't know how we're going to get there. But that indicates there is enough of good heart in the man and sensible Catholic logic in his head that if that's the reason he will use, even when they're going to be mocking him, he will use it. The world must be peopled. I'm going to jump ahead. I'll talk about this tonight again, but it's appropriate here. At the very end of As You Like It, suddenly, from nowhere, I'll talk about this, a Greek god appears. We're out in the forest. Where did this come from? The god Hymen appears. Hymen, the god that blessed marriages. And sings, wedding is great Juno's crown, O blessed bond of board and bed. 'Tis Hymen peoples every town, high wedlock then be honored. Without marriage, the towns won't be peopled. And it's the blessing of marriage that sees to it that the towns are peopled. The world must be peopled. It shows up over and over again in Shakespeare's comedy. It is the ultimate good, and it is the only place where the individual can find the fullness and participation of joy in this world, because marriage is sanctioned by heaven. It's a sacrament. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about those who've chosen a religious life. They are there to bless and help and see that those who have entered into wedlock are able to maintain themselves. But then we're talking again about the social, a functioning social order, which we no longer have. And please notice, it's because marriage is about me, my happiness. And if I marry Susie Schwartz, and we live together for 6 years, and Susie no longer makes me happy, in fact, she really makes me miserable, then I'm going to see that I'm happy, and I'm running off with Dolores, my 23-year-old secretary. And oddly, it doesn't seem to work out. The so-called divorce rate, which is now 60% in America, which is scandalous enough, rises to 80% in second marriages and beyond. Meaning quite simply that if you failed the first time, you're even more likely to fail the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth time. Can you say it? Liz Taylor, okay, or any of other, you know, the ones who are just notorious for marriage after marriage. But again, it's simply serial polygamy. It's polygamy, but you take them one at a time. But you certainly don't take marriage seriously. You certainly don't accept marriage as a sacrament in which there will be troubles, in which there will be crosses, in which there will be sorrows. But if the joy is there from the beginning, and the wisdom and understanding of joy can be sustained through the children, the dedication, the time, the sacraments, the grace of God, then you can go forward. And in spite of the troubles, the social order persists. and the individual can come ultimately to a good end, because the individual that takes marriage seriously will take the Mass seriously, will take confession seriously, and will most likely get last rites and make a good death. But if you don't take marriage seriously, what are the chances of taking the others seriously? Okay? My point being, I'm emphasizing the social, but it's not only the social. There are higher ramifications, much higher ramifications. Now, having said that, what I hope to make clear is that comedy, when I speak of comedy, isn't gags. Comedy is a way of looking at the world. In writing a comedy, comedy is about a structure that moves in a certain direction. Beginning with conflict, beginning with human beings, individuals, somehow troubled with the social order, going through a genuinely difficult period where it looks as if individual happiness is not possible and the social order may be threatened, but moving through it thanks to something higher, to an ending that is happy because it consists of compromise, regeneration, reconciliation, and is blessed with the sacrament of marriage which God gave us, and ends in the dance, which is the ordering of individual joy within the community. Okay? My point is, comedy is fairly serious business. Thank goodness it's also funny. And that's part of the joy. But it's not the jokes. The great comic writers have plenty of good jokes, but they're not as important as the overall sweep of the action and the vision of the world that's being presented. I don't mean to run down jokes. I was raised watching Lunch with Soupy Sales, so my idea of a joke is very simple and quite direct. Man goes to a psychiatrist and says, "Doctor, you've got to help me. I have terrible trouble. What's your problem?" "Half the time I think I'm a wigwam. Half the time I think I'm a teepee." The doctor says, "It's very, very easy. You're too tense." Nothing against jokes. I love them. Okay. Now, let me start in two different places. I'm going to come at the play from two places. One, the title. And two, and Mr. Briano was very smart in this, the little song that actually occurs in Act Two, but he begins the play with it and has Beatrice read the little poem out of the book before the action even starts, okay? It's on page 29 if you've got this book. Otherwise, it's Act 2, Scene 3, line about 60, okay? Act 2, Scene 3, line about 60, or page 29 in this book. It's right before they set up Benedict, okay? Isn't it strange that sheep's guts should hail men's souls from their bodies? It's a wonderful line, just a wonderful line. The singer sings, here are the lyrics. "Sigh no more, ladies, sigh no more. Men were deceivers ever. One foot in sea and one on shore, to one thing faithful, to one thing constant, never. Then sigh not so, but let them go, and be you blithe and bonny, converting all your sounds of woe into hey, nonny, nonny. Sing no more ditties, sing no more, of dumps so dull and heavy. The fraud of men was ever so, since summer first was leafy. Then sigh not so, but let them go, and be you blithe and bonny, converting all your songs of woe into hey, nanny, nanny." In one little song, Shakespeare gives us the play. There was a sociologist. I don't believe in sociology. It's one of those false studies. Anything that ends in ology, be very careful, except theology. There's only one ology that deserves respect. It's called theology. The other's all phony baloney. There was a very famous sociologist, one of the early sociology teachers of the 20th century. She was a fraud. Turns out she was also a liar in many ways, but I won't go into that. But she said one thing absolutely brilliant, and how many people ever do that? So this is to her credit, in spite of all the rest of the dreck that she wrote and said. Her name was Margaret Mead, and she said, the single greatest problem facing any society is, what do we do with the men? And she was absolutely correct in that. Now, I'm going to make a very startling statement. You may not want to write this down. It's a hate crime. I'm a walking hate crime. Everything that comes out of my mouth is just, you know, is not correct in any way. Men and women are very different. Okay. I know this will come as a shock to you. I can be imprisoned for saying it. But it's a fact. Men and women are different. They were created by God to be different. They have very different ways of looking, thinking, behaving, relating to the world, relating to each other. They are totally, completely different. They are the same in being children of God. And one day, facing the judgment seat. But in terms of the way they were made, they are very different. And one of the differences is this. Men have appetites that most of the time are out of control. Men are, as I'm fond of saying, goats. The reason I use that, and not to demean the goats, they're lovely creatures. But goats are totally unleashed appetites. The joke about the goat, and this is absolutely true, this is a true joke, is that goats' appetites are so unleashed, they will eat tin cans. Okay? That is an unleashed appetite. If you can't find anything else to eat, eat a tin can. This suggests an appetite out of control because I don't have to tell you what it does to one's interiors. Men, at their worst, are goats. Unleashed appetites. And they have, whether it be uncontrolled lust, uncontrolled gluttony, uncontrolled pride, men, if they are allowed to let their appetites go, are out of control. Hence, it is a very real problem. If you're going to have a social order that functions, what do we do with the men in order to keep them from running around like goats, behaving like goats, drinking too much, fighting in the streets, firing guns at dump trucks on the beltway? How do we stop this? How do we prevent this? How can we maintain a social order? That is what this play is about. And for that reason, at the core of it, right before Benedict begins undergoing his test, we get this song, and it begins with the reaction of the ladies. Because what the women do, what the women want, what the women hope for, is children and a family. And in order to have children and a family, you have to have civilized men. So the song begins, sigh no more, ladies, sigh no more. Why are the ladies sighing? Men were deceivers ever. Got to keep sighing. You're going to be sighing. They're going to upset you. They're going to disappoint you. There are going to be problems to deal with. They're going to betray you. They're going to be false to you. But that's the way they are. Men were deceivers ever. One foot in sea and one on shore. I taught at the Naval Academy. Sailors are notorious. They come to land, they make all sorts of promises to the women, they get back on the ship and are never seen again. Okay? That is just, it's the stuff of legend for hundreds of years. One foot in sea and one on shore. No, no, no. The women want a man with 2 feet on shore who will stay on shore. Or if he's got 2 feet on sea and goes off, she knows she can trust him and he'll earn his living out there and be moral and decent and come back to her and the 12 kids. But if you've got one on land and one on sea and one on shore, look out. To one thing constant, never. And if the men are not constant, you cannot have families. You cannot have a household. You cannot have a domestic situation. And if you pretend, as the modern world is currently doing, that women can substitute for men and be heads of households or run things in the public sphere and keep it going, you're going to end up with chaos for the simple reason the men will not disappear. They're going to cause such turbulence in the society because they're going to get together and drink and fight and impregnate women outside of marriage. Don John the Bastard, I'll come to him in a moment. That's not accidental. It's part of the play. And that is not an epithet. Shakespeare's using it as a social fact that used to carry an enormous stigma. I.e., you produce a child outside of marriage, it carried a social stigma, as well it should, and one day will again because it must. You're going to have social chaos because the men will not be responsible. They're going to drink and they're going to fight and they're going to carry on and you're going to have a social mess. Then sigh not so, but let them go. Well, it's a song, it's a lyric, but no good woman's going to let a man go. Okay? Converting, or then be, and be you blithe and bonny, just forget about them, converting all your songs of woe into hey, nanny, nanny. Just forget about them and be, come on in, be happy. Well, it doesn't work that way. But it's the core of the problem in the play and in any social order, and there it is, boom, in that song. Okay? So, question number one, how do we civilize the men, and what does it mean to have civilized men, and how can you do it? How can you do it? Because they tend to be creatures of appetite.